Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. More than half of the world's population now lives in cities. By 2050, that number is expected to nearly double. According to Can a City Be Sustainable, the latest edition of the World Watch Institute's State of the World series, there's no question that cities will continue to grow. The big debate is how will they grow? Will they continue to suck up disproportionate shares of the world's energy and resources, or will cities lead the way toward building sustainable, just, and democratic communities and economies? This morning, we talk with Tom Prue, who's author and co-director of Can a City Be Sustainable, and a senior researcher with the World Watch Institute. Tom, welcome to Locus Focus.
Hi, Barbara. Thanks for having me.
Well, I think that the title of your book is like sums up the big question. So I want to start with this very broad picture. Can a city be sustainable?
Well, that's the $64,000 question, isn't it? There are certainly many things cities can do to become more sustainable than they are, and there are things that we must be doing in order to have a shot at achieving sustainability. I think I'm going to leave my answer at that because it's really an unanswerable question until we've done our level best to try to achieve sustainability. We are going to have to do it with cities. I don't think there's any argument about that. As you noted in your intro, more than half of us live in cities now, and that's likely concentrations of people in cities are only likely to increase, although there is a caveat to that I expect we'll touch on some point in our conversation.
Actually, there's an article by Richard Heinberg in the book, which I found very interesting. And Richard's going to be on my show next week, so we can illuminate more on his skepticism. Well, I live in a city that prides itself with, you know, working towards being sustainable. And in your book, Portland is one of the cities that's highlighted, and it mentions it was the first city to have a climate action plan and all these things. But when you scrape beneath the surface of what we do in this wonderfully sustainable, livable city, there's lots and lots of problems and a lot of contradictions. And I kind of wanted to start peeling away some of them. One of the first contradictions that I see with a city being sustainable is, on the one hand, it's often said that cities, because of their density of, well, particularly a city that's built dense, let's say like New York or San Francisco, that they're going to be more energy efficient. People are going to use mass transit more than cars. So the fossil fuel, the carbon footprint will be much lighter. At the same time, and you point this out in one of the articles that you write, cities are also responsible for a vast amount of resource usage in the world. And the way that cities are built actually sort of consolidates a lot of resource extraction and resource usage. And people in the cities like Portland that are doing all these great sustainable things aren't thinking about causes that they might be responsible for, things like deforestation or strip mining or fracking, because of all the resources that come to the city. So how do we balance these two very contradictory forces?
Well, you're really good at coming up with really difficult questions. I don't claim to have the answers to those. It seems to me that if you, as you suggested, strip away some of the surface stuff, you can quickly get down to the fundamentals of why the human presence on the planet right now seems to be fundamentally unsustainable. And that, in a nutshell, is energy and resource use. And we focus on cities because cities are engines of wealth creation. They are the mechanisms of the physical and financial and economic and sociological mechanisms whereby we channel resource inputs and turn them into wealth for ourselves and others. So cities in that role can be made more efficient. But if you strip it all the way down to the very bare bones, it seems to me you're left having to grapple with the question of how much can each person on this planet enjoy in terms of access to wealth, either personal or communal, without pushing the Earth systems over some crucial tipping point to the point where they collapse or significantly degrade and won't support anybody. So I'm not sure that a city-by-city focus is useful in getting to that, although a city-by-city focus can certainly illustrate some of the forces at work and some of the rules we probably ought to pay closer attention to.
Well, a couple of years ago, I remember doing an interview with one of the authors of one of your other State of the World books, and the concern, I think there are several articles in that book that talked about how we are already consuming like two or three planets worth of resources. and the idea. There's one article I remember reading and interviewing the author about how do we get down to where we are actually only consuming one planet's worth of resources or less than
I think we're at 1.5 now, if you believe the Global Footprint Network people. But that's bad enough. Obviously, you can't keep that going either.
Right. And I think that one of the issues that I have with cities, and maybe this is something that we can look at, is that the way that we live in cities really has historically disconnected us from the natural world. And so we're not very conscious, I mean, on really gross things. Like we don't know where our water comes from. We don't know where our garbage goes. We don't really think a lot about where the gas that we put in our car comes from. And so I think that makes it easier in a place like Portland and some other cities that like to think of themselves as being really green cities, that we're doing everything right because we're driving a hybrid car, we're recycling, we're composting, we're doing good things, but not thinking about really where everything is coming from. And I wonder how we can make cities, people in cities, more connected to the places where their resources come from and maybe feel more responsible for those places as well as for the wonderful city that they're living in.
Well, a couple of things come to mind. One is you just keep, you know, plugging away at it. Incremental change, I think, is really the only option here. I don't see a revolution sweeping around the world that's going to turn us into a sustainable global culture overnight. I just don't think things work that way. But a related thing is, as you mentioned or alluded to, I think the book contains a couple of chapters that talk about integrating natural systems with urban systems in a way that brings people into contact with the amenities, the amenity value of nature, at the same time that the city benefits from the ecosystem services value of nature. In fact, the chapter, this is a chapter mainly on Barcelona, but it talks about gray systems, green systems, and blue systems. Gray being sidewalks, roads, buildings, you know, built structures. Green being parks, gardens, trees, shrubs, grasses, green roofs, green walls, and so on. And blue being fountains, standing pools, water bodies, rivers, shorelines, harbors, that kind of thing. And it turns out that there are ways that can those systems can and should be integrated to improve city sustainability at the same time that they bring all the amenities of contact with nature to the people who live there.
Well, actually, that was I really appreciated the chapter on Barcelona, and I wondered actually why the Portland chapter focused more on transportation and less on green infrastructure, which is one thing that I do think Portland has done a very good job in the years that I've lived here. And it may be just the point of view that I have from where the neighborhood that I live in and how much nature there is. But like one of the things I was thinking about on my way over here as I was stuck in traffic, actually, I was thinking about the chapter on biodiversity and the importance of having these basically wildlife refuges within cities, and that here in Portland over the last 30 years, I've seen an incredible increase in the diversity of birds. We also have like a lot more mammals. We have deer living in the city now, and we have coyotes, and that's a whole other issue. But interesting, I mean, I find it interesting to have deer and coyotes as my neighbors along with people. But what importance does that have when we start to, well, actually, before we get to that, I'm just thinking, what brings these wildlife back into the city? What do you have to do so that a city actually becomes a refuge for wildlife as well as for human beings?
Well, I'm certainly no expert on this, but it's obvious that you have to have spaces that serve well as habitat for those whichever animals and wild creatures you're attempting to integrate the city with. So that means both patches and corridors and probably certain kinds of legal and social infrastructure that protect creatures and enable them to live there.
Excuse me, but what do you mean by...
I was struck in reading the chapter on Barcelona's. By the way, the reason we focused on Barcelona is because the people who wrote the chapter are from Barcelona. I'm sure they appreciate what Portland's done as well.
Yeah, well, it's nice to read about other cities that are doing it. And I found the chapter in Barcelona made me really want to go there. But also Jerusalem, I think there's some very interesting biodiversity things that are happening in Jerusalem as well. But before we go on, I was wondering, what do you mean by patches and corridors?
Well, spaces like in New York City, Central Park, for instance, or in in Portland, which I've been to, a lovely city, a wonderful place. I visited a number of times. There's a park smack in the middle of downtown, and I forget the name of it.
Well, there's actually several.
Talking about the one where isn't PSU right on the
park blocks?
Edge of it?
Well, there's the park blocks that go through like the middle of downtown, almost the whole length of downtown.
Yeah.
And then we have like block parks. That there's a number of those. And then actually in the north end of town, there are newer parks. And there's one that's actually, it's Tanner Springs Park. And it's over what is actually a culverted river. And it's kind of a tribute to the wetlands that used to be there. And it's a very nice park because you actually feel like it's a reconstituted wetlands surrounded by cement.
And there's a great park up in the Western Hills, right?
There's a 1,800 acre park.
Yeah,
that's Forest Park.
So that's the kind of thing you need. Places where animals are comfortable living. And one of the things that the Barcelona chapter pointed out is that the more certain animals get used to people, and this is a good thing and a bad thing, it seems to me. Apparently the smaller the amount of space they need to thrive. Or at least to live and reproduce and so on, so that it doesn't take enormous spaces, but it takes adequate spaces and ways for animals to move from some of those patches to some of the other patches. And I don't think that's rocket science. Actually, the old joke is ecological science is a lot more complicated than rocket science, but that sort of arrangement seems to work fairly well. And it's the kind of thing that brings massive amenities to both people and the animals. I was struck by the stories about peregrine falcons nesting on buildings, which is now fairly commonplace, and swifts nesting in the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem, that kind of thing. So animals are quite adaptable, and as long as we're not trying to wipe them out, they can get by in close proximity to us pretty well.
Well, actually,
we benefit by having them there.
I'm thinking of one of the famous wildlife refuges that I've visited was this bridge over the Colorado River in Austin, Texas, which has the largest concentration of bats, definitely in any urban area. But it's a huge number of bats that live under that bridge, and there's a famous moment every evening when they come out. And the night that I went to watch them, it was raining. They didn't come out. But I did see bats flying around midnight that night. But that's like an example of but people come from all around the world to watch the bats fly out of from under the bridge. And the same thing's true with peregrine falcons. And then in Portland, we have the Vos Swifts that the biggest colony nests in a chimney in a grade school in Northwest Portland. And there's a big festival that's going to start in about 2-3 weeks where people come and sit in the lawn of the park and around the school grounds and watch the swifts circle into the chimney every night. So I think that people really love living that close to nature, and that when there's organized ways of educating the community about the importance of nature in the city and these highlights that we have, people get very excited by it.
Yeah, and I think that's especially true. I think you alluded to this earlier, among city people who often find themselves not much aware of what's going on in the natural world around them. So if you can't, move the mountain, take them to where the mountain is. So bringing nature into the city makes a lot of sense from many points of view.
And uses a lot less gasoline.
Exactly.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Tom Prue, who's author and co-director of the new book by World Watch Institute called Can a City Be Sustainable? And we're talking about that, what is a very large question, as we discovered at the very beginning of the show. I wanted to talk about some of the design issues in cities that can create more efficiency and compare them with other design issues that maybe defeat that. One of the articles that really fascinated me was Peter Calthorpe's article about Shanghai and megacities and superblocks, and he calls it global sprawl. And in the article, he talks about the difference between global or high-income sprawl and low-income sprawl in the developing world. So I wanted to touch upon what he means by that and what are those kind of impacts on actually creating a city, a sustainable city, out of this kind of sprawl.
Sure. Peter talks about three types of sprawl. The kind we're most familiar with here in North America is high-income sprawl, and that's where you get, a central city, and then there's kind of a donut. There's central city in the middle, and then spreading out in increasingly, typically increasingly lower densities, is sprawl where, suburbs of single-family houses and eventually McMansions and that kind of thing as you go farther out. That's the one we see around here. The other two kinds, he talks about, particularly in China, what he calls high-density sprawl, and that's where the Chinese have seemed, at least in many places in their cities, have wedded themselves or allowed themselves to be wedded to another kind of automobile-centric development. But in this case, they create very high densities by building super blocks. And he calls these the high-rise version of American suburbs. Some of your listeners may remember there were some low-income housing developments called Pruitt-Igoe. These projects in, I think, either St. Louis or Kansas City, that turned out to be, they thought they were going to be cheap ways to house lots of low-income folks. It turned out to be a nightmare because they failed on almost every dimension of what's needed to make a human settlement a community, and they were eventually destroyed. China is in some ways replicating that kind of thing in these super blocks. These are enormous city blocks, often a quarter of a mile on a side, roughly about 40 acres in size, separated by these vast arterial roads that may be 8 or 10 or even 12 lanes. They're incredibly hostile to pedestrians because it's a death-defying act to get across one of those roads. By the time the light stops blinking at you and says don't walk, there are frequently no local walkable shops or businesses or restaurants. They may house as many as 5,000 people in that 40 acres, which means it's very difficult to achieve any sense of intimacy and knowing who your neighbors are, that kind of thing. And he's demonstrated that it's possible to reconfigure those kinds of blocks to get roughly the same concentration of settlement, but in smaller blocks that house perhaps 1,500 people, which is much more accessible socially. 2.5 to 4 acres per block. They're walkable. They have shops, street-level shops, businesses, restaurants, and so on. So there are jobs that you can walk to. There are places to go that encourage social interaction. They're more secure. They're more pleasant in almost every way. And yet they don't give away much, if anything, in terms of population density. So you can house just about as many people that way and yet make them much more livable. The third kind of sprawl he talks about is low-income sprawl. And the example he uses there is Mexico City. And in fact, he says that kind of sprawl dominates most of what's happening in the developing world. And what that tends to do is leave a actually rather serviceable, compact, walkable core city, but it pushes poor people way out to the periphery and isolates them in informal developments, favelas, slums, barrios, and then fails to supply those places with really good public transit. So if they do have jobs and can find jobs, the poor people living in those favelas are often subject to these exhausting 2 and 3 hour commutes each way. So that's not very sustainable either, apart from the fact that those informal settlements rarely have amenities in the form of safe electricity supply, sewage, fresh water, and so on. Some of the Rio coverage of the Olympics has dwelt on that, although it's hardly Rio's problem alone.
Actually, I was noticing that there's a Google Map app where you can actually look at the favelas, get a tour of them, and I haven't looked at it, but I just thought it's very curious. I wondered, how is this voyeurism, or is this actually some kind of educational opportunity to like understand the economics and the social issues in Brazil?
Probably some of both. I'm sure there's poverty voyeurism out there for sure.
Well, when you describe the low income sprawl, it makes me think that a little bit of that is happening in North American cities. Here in Portland, since the city has been rediscovered by upward income people. A lot of lower income residents have been pushed to the outskirts of the city, and it's not like we have informal bus systems. I mean, there are buses that run out there, but certainly there aren't the kind of services that are close in. There aren't either social services, really good transportation, or the walkable communities that you have close into the city. And people are isolated. Also, they've been separated from some of their heritage communities, and people get dispersed into diasporas in around the suburban core of Portland. So I wonder how this plays into this whole vision of what we're up against, and how would a city, I mean, what would it take to start figuring out that you can't continue to drive people to the fringes of your community, that if we're going to have sustainable cities?
It would take everybody listening to your show.
We're working on that. But
yeah, I know you are. I honestly don't have the answer to that. You can see the same thing happening. This is all over the news. You know what's happening in San Francisco. Housing prices in San Francisco are just insane. And because of the movement of dot-com folks into the center city, they're pushing people out, and there's a huge amount of social and political upheaval going on there around those issues. How can you keep, you know, places that are great to live, like wonderful cities like Portland and San Francisco, ought to be accessible by a wide cross-section of people, not just those who can afford, you know, insane rents. But it's a large political, social, economic question that has dogged us for a long, long time, and probably will for some time. I really don't have a simple turnkey answer to it.
Yeah, well, I think that. I sometimes think that maybe the developers have that turnkey answer, and they're turning the key in the opposite direction. But I wanted to get to an issue that's
That sort of begs the question in a way. I mean, who's letting the developers get away with that?
Right. Well, the developers, it seems to me, in most cities that I've studied, actually fund the election campaigns of all the city councilors and sometimes the county commissioners. And so they have an awful lot of say in how things are run. And I think that's been true here in Portland, and underneath the surface of, you know, we profess to believe in all this kind of good stuff and equity and conservation and environmentalism. And underneath that, it's really driven by the dollar and by probably a fair amount of greed in how the city's getting developed. And that gets me to my next question.
Can I just jump in there and offer a hobby horse of my own, which is I'm a deep believer in the potential of neighborhood self-governance and grassroots democracy, and building it from the bottom up as an antidote to a great deal of what we see wrong with our current systems of top-down democracy. That's a topic for another show or shows, but I will point out that Portland has a certain tradition of that. I don't know how robust it is anymore, but the EcoDistricts outfit is active in Portland as well as in other cities. And that might be evidence that it's not dead yet, for sure.
Well, that's a conversation. Let's have that on another show sometime in the near future, because I'm real interested in that. I mean, because that's what we're really facing here. One of the big contentions right now in Portland is that we are experiencing a great deal of infill, where there used to be more open space in the neighborhoods, lower buildings, actually fair number of empty lots, some very nice green spaces and neighborhood, maybe impromptu neighborhood gardens. And now they're all getting filled up with these 4 to 5 to 6 story mixed-use buildings with pretty much high-end apartments, even in neighborhoods that were traditionally very low income. And a lot of them are these boxy, same-looking structures. And they're not as big and as edificial as the ones in Shanghai or other Chinese cities. But I think that people in Portland feel on a lower scale. I mean, when they see a 4-story building, which is kind of what you were describing to replace these edifices in Shanghai, to them, in their 2-story building neighborhood, the 4-story block, you know, full block buildings, feel that same way of alienation and really kind of a disturbance in their sense of what the community should be like. So I'm wondering how we integrate a sense of a need for having more density and building more efficiently, at the same time maintaining the characters of neighborhoods that have a very long tradition in which people feel very connected to.
Well, there's no free lunch, is there? It's always trade-offs. You can enact certain protections for neighborhood character in things like zoning codes, and lots of places have done that very actively. I used to live in Boulder for a few years, and Boulder has an ordinance that prohibits you from doing anything that blocks the solar access of your neighbor. So if you're to the south of a neighbor and you want to put up a, you want to pop up your house by adding a second story to it, you can do that, but it may require you to build that second story with a setback so that you're not putting any of your neighbor's yard into the shade. And that kind of thing seems to work. But like I said, this is why local politics, a robust system of local politics where these kinds of issues can be adjudicated civilly, is so important, in my view. Otherwise, you wind up with some distant bureaucracy that is susceptible to political pressures and big money making all those decisions, leaving a lot of people ticked off. So, you know, you sort of pays your money and you takes your choice.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Tom Prue, who's author and co-director of Can a City Be Sustainable, a new book by World Watch Institute in their annual State of the World series. And we're talking about how to make our cities more sustainable at the same time as we deal with all the intense challenges. One of the things that I really got from reading your book, and then I've simultaneously been reading Our Renewable Future by Richard Heinberg, and realizing this is really a hard thing to do if we're going to really get ourselves off of fossil fuels and get ourselves off of all the things that fuel our cities. How do we maintain a way of life that is familiar to us, or what do we have to let go of? And Richard Heinberg, I think, has a sort of a view of we have to let go of a lot more than a lot of people want to let go of. And then there's Dick Cheney, who says that, you know, driving an SUV gas guzzler is a right of every American's right to do. So somewhere in between that, maybe we would find some way of some path forward. But what can we do? I mean, one of the things that you talk about, the kind of the democratization of cities and communities and having our power come from the bottom up. One of the things that makes me think of is distributed energy and ways of heating and cooling and generating energy that are done by the community rather than done on these massive systems. So let's talk about some of the ideas that are proposed in the book about how we can power our communities in a way that is more self-generated.
Well, we can certainly do that, and I think that would be good. It seems to me, if you'll forgive me for saying so, that the more important question is the one you started out that question with, which is, what are we going to have to let go of? Because there's sort of two schools of thought here, if I can boil this down to an oversimplification. There are the eco-modernists. Those are the folks who believe that all we need to do, well, we may have to work really hard at it, but all we really need to do is to introduce widespread use of electric vehicles, distributed generation, improve battery storage technologies, erect more wind farms and solar farms, and fiber optic systems, and ultra-low temperature long-distance transmission lines, and all the rest of it, and we will be able to continue. Oh, and also technologies to sequester carbon, pull carbon out of the atmosphere, et cetera, et cetera. That's sort of the eco-modernist way of looking at things, that the technology is the cavalry, and all we have to do is listen really hard for the bugles, and pretty soon it'll be arriving and get us out of this so we can continue to live in this very high consumption, very wealthy way, and that everybody on the planet can do that. In contrast, there is what you might call the eco-transitionist school, which is where I think Richard Heinberg comes from, which argues that, yeah, we need to do some of those technological things, but even if we do all those things or try to, we're not going to be able to do all the things we can dream about. And even if we could do all those things, they're not going to get us far enough to enable us to continue living the way we in America live. Much less enable the rest of the 7.5 billion people on the planet, not to mention the other 2.5 or 3 billion that'll be with us by 2050, to live the way we do. It's just not going to work. So we need to get much more efficient in resource use, much more efficient in wringing well-being out of what resources we do use. But even so, we're going to have to let go of some things. And to Richard's mind, I think that means probably relocalization, transitioning to lower consumption culture. It doesn't mean going back to the Middle Ages. I don't think he's saying that at all. I think it means a sort of different quality of life that isn't so machine-dependent, so dependent on external stimuli. It's more people-oriented. It's more localized. There may be more people raising more of their own food and that sort of thing. And you're not going to hop on an airplane to travel to London every year for your vacation, and you're not going to be buying blueberries brought up in the winter from Chile anymore. So it'll be different. Fruit will be seasonal, not year-round,
and taste much better.
That kind of thing, but it's not a horrible way of life by any means. And in many ways, it would be far superior, seems to me.
Well, actually,
so those are the two-way broad camps I see things sort of splitting into.
Yeah, well, actually, the second one is sort of describing the world that we probably both grew up in. I mean, I was really surprised. Sometime I woke up about 20 years ago and thought, why am I seeing asparagus in January? And why am I seeing strawberries in December? And realized that all this food was coming from halfway around the world and from the Southern Hemisphere. And I realized very quickly none of it tasted very good. And it seemed to me, it disturbed me at the time, because I grew up at a period where seasons were connected to what was in season and you ate seasonally. Mm-hmm. It was not a revolutionary thing to do in the early 60s, but it certainly seems to be a revolutionary thing to do now.
Yeah, I mean, I'm old enough, I hesitate to admit this, but I'm old enough to remember where I was when Kennedy was assassinated. And apart from the assassination, life wasn't so bad then. You know, we didn't have cell phones. I sound like a geezer now. We had telephones. There was television. You could go to movies. You could play sports. You could do all kinds of things. You couldn't do it on the Internet because it didn't exist. People grow up with the technologies that are prevalent when they come of age and think that's the norm and cannot imagine rolling the clock back. And yet, if you think about it, just how fundamentally miserable was life before the Internet. To my way of thinking, not miserable at all for somebody like me, being a white middle-class guy growing up in 1960s and 70s in the United States. That's to say that we don't need all the stuff we've got right now to be happy. Humans never have needed all that stuff. It's just what we take to be normal.
We used to have to work a little harder. I mean, the big thing the Internet changed for me was I didn't have to go to the library to do research. I could just do it from my own office. And it's nice. It's a nice convenience. But I think about, and the libraries have adapted, and now the libraries have lots of computers and give people access that wouldn't have it otherwise. But I think that there's something about the putting a little more effort into things, which is one of the issues I always had with flying, is like when you fly across the country, you have no sense of what the country's like. When you drive across the country, you get to see what the country is. And I think if you walked across it, you'd really get to know it.
Well, I have to say, I think in general you're basically right. But although flying is not great, I mean, you can drive a Prius, and if you drive a normal number of miles, and then you take one airplane trip, you've wiped out all the carbon savings that you achieve by driving a Prius that is two or three times as efficient as an ordinary car. But just as a footnote, I would say that I love sitting by the window on a jetliner and watching the landforms pass beneath the wing. There are things out there that I wish I had a geologist sitting next to me so I could ask them about them, because they're just fascinating. So you can get to see parts of the country that way that you can't see by being at road level. But that's not to argue your point, really.
Yeah, actually, I agree. I mean, I got to really understand the Colorado River Basin and the Columbia River Basin from seeing them from the air. And one time I was coming down the Columbia on a plane and went, my God, it looks just like the map, and that's a revelation when you realize maps are actually representing something that you can see from space. But I guess the thing that really gets me annoyed, more than annoyed, kind of horrified, is like the level of obsolescence, built-in obsolescence, which I heard about that when I was a kid in the 60s and in the late 50s. But it seems like we've taken it so much further. I got an email a couple of weeks ago about sending a petition to Apple to stop advertising the next iPhone after the 7 that's coming out next year, that we're already gearing people up for the one that's going to come out the year after, and start building phones that will last for years. And I think that that's one of the things that really bothers me, is that we are so used to things being obsolete so fast, and that the idea of having a piece of equipment or tool or anything that you buy and love and want to, you know, hold on to for a really long time, and our whole system is now goes against that. And that's one of the things I saw in Richard Heinberg's article too, was talking about having people get back to a life where things last and where you repair them and you restore them. And I wonder, how do we, I don't know if how, but how do you, what kind of track of path do you see that it would take to get from this instant obsolescence back to a place where we build things to last?
Well, I find it impossible to imagine that happening without strong government intervention, and that would, and the political will and cover for that would have to come from people. You know, the system of planned obsolescence is an engineered system. It was created on purpose, beginning early in the 20th century, and particularly after World War II, when the economy, the American economy anyway, had grown as though on steroids in response to being on a war footing. In order to defeat the Axis powers, the economic might of the country was just built up enormously. And I believe policymakers were quite frightened when the war ended with what was going to happen if all that economic capacity and therefore the jobs that were connected with it were allowed to subside once again to pre-war levels of economic activity. I think that was politically simply unacceptable. Nobody had the imagination to think about ways that you could simply fairly and equitably spread around the work that was that needed to be done and was available at the time among all the people who needed it. We still haven't solved that problem. So they basically set out to engineer ways to keep that economic capacity engaged. And there's a famous quote by a guy named Victor Lebo, I think it dates from 1954 or so, that has to do with we must make people buy more and more, we must make them tired of what they have, we must engineer things to wear out so they can't do without the next new thing. I'm paraphrasing wildly, but it's something. My point is that this is an engineered system, and we can engineer it to not be like this, too, if we can find the political intensity and will to do it.
Well, the one last thing I wanted to get back to is the whole idea of rebuilding communities and going small. And this kind of gets back to Richard Heinberg's article about how he sees the quite a great possibility that cities will actually shrink in the future. And I was thinking how I moved from New York and San Francisco to Portland, and a lot because I wanted to live in a smaller city. And in Portland, I found a community I didn't ever find in a larger city. And I wonder if you see a vision for us returning to smaller communities, even if they're communities within larger cities, and how that would really reshape our culture.
Well, I think that would be an integral part of following Peter Calthorpe's new urbanism ideas about how to make a city work. If it's compact, it's mixed use, it's walkable, it's economically integrated, and it's transit-oriented, then you automatically wind up with something more like neighborhood focus. It doesn't mean you're insular and cut off from everybody else by any means, especially not in the age of mass communication and the Internet. But it does mean you can cultivate a neighborhood focus and cultivate that sense of belonging to more intensely to a particular locale than necessarily to a larger one. And I think that's possible now, but even more likely to happen if Richard Heinberg prophecies turned out to be correct. For instance, if fossil fuels become much more expensive in the mid to long term and we have to sharply curtail their use, then agriculture, the industrial agriculture model, is going to have a hard time surviving, and that's going to require more farm labor. It's going to mean more people working on farms. It's going to mean less transport, because it's too expensive, long-distance transport of foodstuffs. So that might mean more people moving out from cities back into smaller farming communities that have been depopulated, at least in this country, over the last several decades.
Well, Tom, it's really
quite possible, it seems to me.
Yeah, actually, to me, it looks like a really positive vision. And I'd like to talk about it more with you. Actually, I'd like to have you back on soon, and we can talk about the idea of creating democracy from the grassroots, from the bottom up, and maybe envisioning breaking our communities into more livable units as well. So
I'd be happy to talk about that.
Okay.
That'd be a lot of fun.
Well, we'll talk about that off the air in a little while. So anyway, okay. Thanks so much for joining us. It's a fascinating conversation and a very important topic for all of us to be struggling with as we are trying to make our own cities a little bit more sustainable. So thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Barbara.
Sure.
Thanks.
We've been talking with Tom Prue, who's author and co-director of Can a City Be Sustainable? And you've been listening to Locust Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week, we'll talk about what a 100% renewable future looks like with Richard Heinberg, who we were just mentioning quite a bit about, and we'll get his view about running out of resources and what that really means. His latest book is Our Renewable Future. My engineer is Natasha Delapine. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Charles Mingus. Thanks for listening.